Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll free, 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to the Monday edition of Catholic Answers Live, a very special Monday edition for you. We reserve open forum to Tuesdays and Thursdays, but we thought we'd do a little open forum to start today. This hour, Mark Brumley will be with us for open forum. Second hour, we're going to talk about roadblocks to the faith with Don Johnson, filmmaker and author and radio host. Don Johnson will be here to talk about roadblocks to the faith.
Hey, can I say something about Don Johnson real quick?
Yes, you can, Mark Brumley.
Not the Miami Vice Don Johnson.
No, the other Don Johnson,
but
right.
But this Don Johnson, he's working on a film project on Humanae Vitae with Ignatius Press, so say hi to him.
Oh, yeah. We're reserving that conversation for when the movie comes out.
Yes.
But the movie's on I didn't make the connection with Humanae Vitae. That's the 50th anniversary this year, so the movie will be out this year.
It will be.
Oh.
Soon to a theater near you.
See how sharp I am, Mark?
That's right.
Probably heard about the movie 50 times and never made the connection. I'm really looking forward to it, though, because he's going to really tackle the whole sexual revolution thing there, which is I'm amazed at how many young people today don't even know that the sexual revolution happened. They don't know that something huge happened and it changed the whole world.
Yes, that's right. They don't. They just assume things have always been like this, except maybe in long ago times,
olden days,
100, 200 years ago, things were different. They know that much, because they've learned that from watching movies.
Yeah, right. 888-31-TRUTH is our number, 888-318-7884. Open forum means you can ask any question you've got about the Catholic faith, about what we Catholics do or believe, or why we do and believe those things. You most certainly do not have to be Catholic to call. Anyone is welcome to call. So if you got something that you'd like to get straightened out about us Catholics, 888-318-7884. As I said, Mark Brumley is our guest, and Mark is the president of Ignatius Press, one of the nation's largest publishers and distributors of videos and music. Mark was a staff apologist here at Catholic Answers. He's the author of The Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics. But something I wanted to ask you about today, you also made a movie called Did Jesus Really Rise from the Dead? And that's a good one for this time of year.
Yes, it was a film. Yeah, we produced, Ignatius Press produced a film several years ago on that topic, which was basically setting out the arguments for the resurrection of Jesus. Some of the content, same content, well, obviously it's the same content because it's the same Jesus who rose from the dead, is in this book that Carl Olson did with the same title. But the video we did, the film we did, we interviewed top scripture scholars, Protestant and Catholic, to present the evidence, the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And, it's interesting. I don't know why this is so. I'd love for you to say to me, Cy, you're wrong, Mark, and here's why. But my experience has been that for whatever reason, there's a lot more interest in the resurrection of Jesus, at least the apologetical case for the resurrection of Jesus, among Protestants and even among skeptics than there is among Catholics. And maybe it's because we Catholics just believe this, and but that's been my experience. I can say, I'm going to give you an argument why sola scriptura doesn't work, or why Peter is the rock which the church is founded on, and that's the papacy. And Catholics will eat it up. They say, I want to give you an argument for the resurrection of Jesus. My experience has been there's not as much enthusiasm about it.
I'm not going to say you're wrong, but I wouldn't have thought that. But it does make sense, actually, now that you say it. And among skeptics, it seems like, I guess in every way, kind of a skeptical approach has become the vogue in recent years, social media and all that. So I just need to know, though, do you answer the question, did Jesus rise from the dead? Like, did you come down with a yes on that? I'm hoping that it's Ignatius.
Yeah, we came down with a yes.
Oh, you did? Okay, good.
After extensive argumentation back and forth.
All right. The
film does a great job of presenting, here are the arguments. Here are the alternate possibilities of what happened to Jesus. And then it shows how those alternative explanations don't work as well as the explanation of the resurrection. Now, of course, do I think it's a slam, absolute, foolproof argument? No, because obviously, if it were that, I wouldn't have to have faith.
Yeah,
you know?
Right, right.
But I think it does say, look, there's good, credible evidence to point to something extraordinary happening to Jesus and something extraordinary happening as a result to his disciples who encountered him. And so what? How do we make sense of that? So it's a great film. I think this Easter, it would be a wonderful thing to for parishes across the country to show that film. I think it would be wonderful for people to watch it on Formed. It's available on the digital platform Formed.
Yeah.
So
you know, and part of why in addition to just, you know, having your faith reinforced in Christ, this time of year, you get next week, I'm expecting it. Usually you get, it comes really the TV news stories on some weird aspect of,
right.
of a possible, you know, they found the
Jesus was a Martian.
Yeah. Like, right. Exactly. That's it. And you'll see this stuff in mainstream media all, you know, one year it'll be Mary Magdalene. And she was the wife of Jesus and everybody's got that. And another year it's a new, you know, Gnostic 5th century gospel that proves right. something about, you know, like something there's, I don't know what that's about. I guess.
Well, I think,
go ahead.
I mean, people are interested in Jesus.
Yeah.
And the mainstream media knows, okay, there's interest in Jesus, and that interest is takes on a couple different forms. One is the traditional sort of orthodox way yeah. of looking at things, and they present these things to kind of provoke against that. So people who are committed to the Christian faith and understanding who Jesus is and that he rose from the dead and all of that, they see these stories and they say, well, I'm going to look at that. So they get those folks, and then the people that reject Christianity or who want to radically reinterpret it, they get them because those folks think, oh, well, maybe there's some arguments here. There's some evidence here
oh, yeah.
that will cause me to think about this differently. And so I think that Jesus remains popular. These biblical topics related to Jesus remain popular, and they kind of try to get you coming and going.
Mark Brumley is our guest. 888-31-TRUTH is our number. It's an open forum today, so any question you've got is welcome. And lots of callers already. Mark, shall we try to get to one before the break here?
Sure.
Lou in Springfield, Illinois, you are on with Mark Brumley. Your question, please, Lou.
Good evening. Thanks for taking my call.
My question
is, I would like to get tattoos of the five sorrowful mysteries. Is that a sin?
Oh, wow. One of my favorite questions. Are tattoos a sin? And I'm going to just say there are different views of this. There are some Catholics who are very strict in their interpretation of respect for the body, which is part of the fifth commandment. Not that tattoos are, you know, the fifth commandment is you shall not kill. Not that tattoos are killing. But the fifth commandment more generally concerns respect for the human body and human life. And so they would say, you know, tattoos are not appropriate, that this is marring or distorting the body that God has given us. Other people look at it differently. They see it as a kind of ornamentation. And so long as it's not, you know, you don't have some kind of hypersensitivity to the process of receiving a tattoo, or so long as you don't receive tattoos to such a degree that it really does become overwhelmingly disfiguring, those folks say it's okay. So I'm just giving you the different perspectives. I don't think there is an established knockdown, drag out argument for or against, and I don't think the church has weighed in on this in a definitive way. But I'm happy to be corrected if somebody has a different view.
Does that help you,
okay.
Lou?
Yes, it does. I just, you know, I don't want to do something that's going to put my soul in jeopardy, and it wouldn't be anything distasteful, but I just right. want to make sure I'm doing right by the Catholic Church. And I
yeah, you know, and I think
answer my question.
I think it'd be good for you to talk to your pastor about it.
Okay, well, all right. Okay, Lou. I like the I don't want to do anything to put my soul in jeopardy. I feel like that's a good plan for everything that you set out to do. Right. That's like a baseline. Right. Start there. Good start, Lou. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press, with us for an open forum. Any question that you have on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, they are all welcome. 888-318-7884 is the number. We'll be right back.
Tim Staples, Trent Horn, Cy Kellett, Chris Check, Carlo Broussard. Our On Fire lineup of speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker for your event, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today. God helps those who help themselves. Preach the gospel always. When necessary, use words. We all hear sayings like these, and we assume they come from the Bible, the saints, or famous Christian writers. Nobody can seem to place their origin, but by sheer repetition, they've acquired a halo of truth. In my new book, What the Saints Never Said, I look at over 40 of these well-known sayings and track them back to their original sources. You'll be surprised at what I found. Some are close to what was really said. Many were misattributed or twisted beyond their original meaning, and more than a few of these sayings were simply made up. I hope by setting the record straight, I can make you aware of the theological errors that can lead us away from the faith and offer you authentic quotes from scripture, saints, and scholars that will draw you closer to our faith. Get your copy of What the Saints Never Said by calling 1-888-291-8000, by visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or by asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking resource by apologist Trent Horn. That one book that you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into or back to the practice of the Catholic faith. This Lent, plant seeds of faith in the hearts and minds of your non-Catholic friends and family. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today. You can order your copies of Why We're Catholic by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I am Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Mark Brumley, the president of Ignatius Press. And during the break, Mark was giving me a quiz on the documents of the Second Vatican Council that I did not score very highly on.
You did a great job.
Yeah.
Just the one, because you're in social communications, you know.
Yeah, there's a document, right? The Second Vatican Council has a relatively minor document, Inter Mirifica, which is on social communications. And I was going to make a joke about that's the most important one because that's what we do here is radio. Right. And it's got a whole thing on radio. But I couldn't remember the name of it. That's embarrassing. I figure I could probably – I think there's 16 documents of the Second Vatican Council, right? Yeah. I think if we weren't on the air and I had no anxiety, I could probably do 8 out of the 16. Could you could do all 16?
No, I probably – well – I have done. I know all 16, and I've done them before. But I usually, when I do them, I miss one, I forget one, so I have to be. There are two issues. First, do you remember all the documents? That is to say, the topics, you know.
Right.
And then second, do you remember all the names, the Latin names? And I usually will forget one or the other.
Like of the Latin
the
names.
Declaration on Christian Education. I can't, off the top of my head, I can't remember what the Latin title is.
Christianus Edumacationibus.
No, it's
that's not even Latin.
It's close though. But I forgot it off the top of my head. I can't.
That's funny. Yeah. But the one something many people don't know, and you did also mention this at the break, there are four main documents of
right.
and there's even a chief among those four main documents. But the four main documents are the constitutions.
Right. Sometimes when I give talks on Vatican II, as I did a couple of years ago, I was giving a lot of talks because it was that window of time when we were in the 50th anniversary, either the beginning or the middle or the end of the Second Vatican Council. I would be giving talks and I would realize I would use the word the four constitutions. And the first couple times I did it during the Q&A, almost always, somebody would say, well, the constitutions, there's like a constitution for the church. And they thought of it as being like the U.S. Constitution.
Right, right.
That the apostles sat down,
wrote a
constitution, and that the councils were these meetings where the bishops would get together and they would amend the constitution. So I had to say, no, that's not the sense in which it's a constitution. It's a constitution in a way akin to when we think of our constitution as a leading document that describes our nation. Yeah, those four constitutions are like that. They describe aspects of the Christian life. But they're not constitutions in the sense that they lay down the fundamental laws and establish the fundamental offices of the church. Jesus did that.
Yeah.
The apostles didn't, nor have the bishops as their successors.
Right. But would you agree with me, Lumen Gentium is the chief among all the documents of the Second Vatican Council? Yes. Okay, moving on.
I would say, obviously, it's a dogmatic constitution of the church. It's very, very important because as Pope John Paul II, as Carol Wojtyla said in his book on the Council Sources of Renewal, he talks about Lumen Gentium as the church asking the council, as the church asking, what do you say for yourself? And in one sense, Lumen Gentium is the answer to that. This is what the church says for itself.
Yeah.
But you can also say, since the church abides in the Word of God, the Word of God is what calls us into being and shapes us and guides us. There's a sense in which Dei Verbum has a prominence.
Yeah.
Since we come together and the Eucharist makes the church and the church makes the Eucharist, to use the De Lubachian expression, there's a sense in which Sacrosanctum Concilium on the sacred liturgy is central. So that's what I'd say.
Well, you have to say the fourth constitution now. You've named three of them. And so the fourth was Gaudium et Spes. Yeah.
Which is the constitution, the pastoral constitution on the church in the modern world. And of the four documents, it probably was the one that many people in the period immediately after the council thought was the most important, because what it did is it took the church's self-understanding and the understanding of the church's mission and said, how do we understand that in the world that we're in today?
Yeah.
Past the church and the world as it is today. And so a lot of people thought it was most important, but because in one sense, because it was trying to be so contemporary.
But it's dated
and
now.
Relate the church to the times.
Yeah.
It's in a certain sense the one that becomes dated the quickest.
Yeah,
because
right.
Times change. So.
Well, all right. We're going to go back to calls. It's open forum here on Catholic Answers Live. Mark Brumley is our guest. But before we go back to calls, and I will do that presently, here's a book pitch for you. I think someone should do a commentary on just the first two chapters of Lumen Gentium, because those chapters are so rich in what the church is. Like you could get the whole catechism out of those first two chapters.
So you're talking about like a popular commentary, because there are a number of commentaries out there, but some more popular. That would be a good thing to do.
All right. Find someone. Get it done. You're a publisher.
You're working on that, Si.
Okay, sure. Timothy.
When will we have the manuscript?
Any day now. Timothy in Kerrville, Texas, listening on 97.9. You are on with Mark Brumley. Timothy, your question.
Yes. Hello. I was just going to ask what the Jesus' last words were, because I was reading the Gospels, and in Matthew, I believe he said, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, and then I think it's Mark or Luke, his last words were to see the thief that was next to him on the cross about, today you'll be with me in paradise. And then I think in John, his last words were, it is finished. And I was just curious, which one it was, and like, how do you distinguish which one's more credible, I guess? And that was it, the question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. First thing we should understand, although you mentioned four Gospels, three of them are very similar. In fact, they're so similar, they're called synoptic, meaning that they see things more or less from the same point of view. But and that's Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John, the fourth Gospel, is somewhat different, significantly different from how it presents Jesus. The basic outline of Jesus' life and his teaching and the things that he says and does, that basic outline is the same, more or less, over all four Gospels. But the Gospels approach the same material, sometimes from somewhat different perspectives or different points of emphasis. And of course, Matthew and Luke are the Gospels that have sort of Jesus' backstory, what we call the infancy narratives, the story of Jesus when he was young. And so they're different in that way. So with respect to the crucifixion, obviously all four Gospel accounts have not only the resurrection of Jesus, but they have the crucifixion. How did Jesus rise from the dead? Well, he had to be killed first, and the crucifixion is the account of his death. There's a lot that's the same. If you look especially at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you'll see that with respect to the account of Jesus' crucifixion, there's a lot that's the same. But again, they're going to emphasize different points. So you're going to have some differences when it comes to what Jesus said on the cross. Not that Luke denies that Jesus said the things that are in Mark, or Matthew rejects the things that are unique to Luke, but they have different points of emphasis. No gospel writer is giving us the exhaustive account, every single thing that was said and done by Jesus or anyone else in association with his crucifixion. No, as I say, no gospel account is giving us the exhaustive account of it. So they're selecting certain things to make certain points. Now, the question is, what are Jesus' last words? Well, I want to make one point with respect to the caller. In Luke's gospel, what Jesus says, crying out, it says in Luke chapter 23, verse 46, it says, "Then Jesus, crying out with a loud voice, said, 'Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.' And having said this, he breathed his last." So Luke says those were the last words of Jesus. He does talk to the good thief on the cross, but what he says to the good thief don't constitute Jesus' last words. If you look in John's gospel, as the caller noted, Jesus does say it is finished at one point, or it is accomplished, or it's brought to completion. That's the idea. Now, is John saying it's the very, very, very last thing Jesus said? Not necessarily. So we would say among the many things that Jesus said on the cross, he certainly said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." According to Luke, he says that and he passes away. He certainly said it is finished at some point. He uttered those words towards the end of his time on the cross. Interesting that Mark's account says only this. It says that in verse 37 of Mark 15, Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. We're not told what he says there. You'll remember in Luke says he also uttered a loud cry, but Luke tells us what was said: "Father, in your hands I commit my spirit." And then Matthew has the following. Matthew says, very simply, "And Jesus cried again with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit." So you see, Matthew doesn't tell us what he says, but his way of describing the words of Christ, very similar to what we see in Mark. The caller mentioned Jesus' quotation from Psalm 22 when he says, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," or "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus is quoting the psalm there. And Matthew and Mark both indicate that Jesus quoted that psalm. And then they say that they don't go into any detail or give us much description of what else the Lord said on the cross, except that at the very end of his life, he utters a loud cry and passes away. And as you say in Luke, he spells that out. Notice Luke is the one that has the most detailed account of what Jesus says. Luke has Jesus on the cross saying, you know, "Father, forgive them, they don't know what they do." He has Jesus on the cross having this conversation with the good thief. He has that comment I quoted, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. John is the second, I don't want to say the most verbose Jesus. John has the account where Jesus speaks second most on the cross. He talks to Our Lady and his mother on the cross, and then says, "It is finished." So we have Jesus saying and doing lots of things at the end of his life. Each gospel writer is recording some aspect of what the Lord says. No gospel writer purports to tell you the whole thing. Each one tells you what he wants to tell you to make a point about what the meaning of the cross is, and Jesus' death on the cross is. So does that help?
Yeah, it did. Absolutely.
Thank you. Well, that worked out just perfectly. The music came on just as that concluded, and it was helpful to Timothy. Thanks, Timothy, for the call. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Mark Brumley is our guest from Ignatius Press, and we'll be right back with your calls right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Open Line Tuesday with Father Wade Meneses.
The Catechism is very clear in Numbers 1033, 1035, and 1037 that it takes only one mortal sin to have one go to hell by their own doing. God sends no one to hell.
Open Line with Father Wade Meneses, Tuesday afternoon, 3 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
50 years ago, Blessed Pope Paul VI released his encyclical Humanae Vitae, reaffirming the Catholic Church's condemnation of contraception. Catholic Answers magazine is marking the anniversary with a very special issue delving deep into what is arguably one of the Church's most controversial documents in modern times. Want to be sure to get your copy? Subscribe right now to the best Catholic apologetics magazine anywhere by calling 818-487-2011 or by going to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com. Don't miss out on what will be a virtual handbook on the most important aspects of Paul VI's profound and prophetic document. Don't wait another moment to subscribe. Call 818-487-2011 or go to the shop at Catholic.com right now to get subscriptions for yourself and those you love. Share the faith. Defend the faith. Catholic Answers Magazine from Catholic Answers, the most trusted name in Catholic apologetics.
Looking for an on-fire Catholic speaker for your event? Catholic Answers speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Any question you have on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church is welcome. And our guest is Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press. 888-318-7884 is our number. If you prefer the spelled version, 888-31-TRUTH. And we were speaking a while ago about the 50th anniversary of Humanae Vitae, the kind of prophetic and also crisis-inducing encyclical from Blessed Pope Paul VI in 1968. And we have a great, wonderful issue coming out of Catholic Answers magazine in May and June. We'd love you to get it. It's one you want to keep around. You know, it's that kind of thing with all kinds of really profound writing on Humanae Vitae. So you just go to CatholicAnswersMagazine.com, subscribe. You get $10 to $20 off the normal subscription price right now. And if you're subscribing now, then you're definitely going to get the May-June issue, which is entirely devoted, the whole issue, to the history and the context and the meaning of Humanae Vitae. Certainly, 1968 was a crisis year, and Humanae Vitae, for the whole world, probably. And Humanae Vitae, we could say the reception of it was less successful than would have been desired, in large part because the world, and certainly the world of family and marriage and sexuality and all that, was in turmoil at the moment that it came out. Let us go now to Eileen in Toms River, New Jersey. Eileen, you are on with Mark Brumley. Your question, please, Eileen.
Oh, okay. Hi. My question is, why and when was the sixth precept of the church removed from publication?
The sixth precept of the church. Hold on a second here. Let me pull down my copy of the Catechism of the Catholic Church here.
Mark's getting yeah, there we go.
I don't happen to remember what the sixth precept of the church is off the top of my head here.
Do you remember it, Eileen?
Yeah, you shall marry according to the precepts of the rules of the church.
Oh, okay. Well, let me make a somewhat unpopular observation about the precepts of the church. The precepts of the church are a summary of duties or responsibilities that the church wants to emphasize at a particular time and place, but that doesn't mean there can't be additional ways of formulating what are the precepts of the church. So with respect to the requirement to observe the laws of the church regarding marriage, that is still in force. It may not be numbered among the things called the precepts of the church. I don't know why that was altered, but Catholics are still obliged to follow the teaching of the church as regards marriage. That has not changed.
Correct. But I was just curious as to why and when it was removed. It seems in this day and age that the last one I would have removed, you know, from people's consciousness.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I can't answer that question. I'll look into it, though, see what I can find out.
Okay, Eileen?
Well, okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks. Oh, we don't get stumpers that often. But that's a...
Yeah.
That's a... That's not something that you're... that's to the top of mind at all times, so...
Why that was altered, I'm not sure.
Okay. Let's go to Steve in Lubbock, Texas at listening on Our Lady of Victory Radio. Steve, you are on with... Mark Brumley, your question, please.
Hi there. So I'm a college student, and one of the things I've noticed among friends and, you know, people my age is a lot of people that struggle with anxiety and depression. A little bit earlier when I tuned in, you guys were talking about the sexual revolution and kind of the culture shift and how a lot of the young people don't know about that. Is there any connection with, or can you explain to me the connection between maybe young people struggling with these things and then how the culture has changed?
Good question. I mean, I think there is a connection. I think, first of all, human beings have a remarkable amount of flexibility. But that remarkable amount of flexibility, or we might say adaptability, is not infinite. So there are certain things that you can do and become accustomed to. Your culture can foster and promote bad habits or bad practices. And human adaptability will allow within a range, a fixed range, some ability to change and adapt and even to survive and to some degree thrive with those changes. But it's not infinite. Human nature remains the same. And when you take something like human sexuality, which is very core to our being as human beings, and you begin messing around with it, and you begin encouraging a culture or way of life where there's sexual promiscuity, where there is going from sexual relationship to sexual relationship to sexual relationship, that begins to take its toll. It takes its toll in the form of physical ailment. People get sexually transmitted diseases. It takes a toll in the form of psychological ailment. You become go from one attachment, deep attachment, to another deep attachment, to another deep attachment. It's going to have an effect on you, how you enter into relationships, your ability to maintain relationships, and so on. And then, of course, it has a profound spiritual impact on the person. Is a person, if that person is at all open to the spiritual, at all open to God or a relationship with God, and there's some sense that I'm misusing my sexuality, even if it's only implicit and unconscious, it begins to take its toll. It's not surprising that people experience depression or confusion, disorientation, inability to remain in a relationship or remain committed in an exclusive relationship. It's what we would expect from the fact that we're made in the image and likeness of God and called to relate to one another as men and women in very specific ways. Mary Eberstadt wrote a book which I recommend to people who want to try to understand the sexual revolution and its impact on our society. It's called Adam and Eve After the Pill. The pill is the birth control pill, which was very important to the sexual revolution and all the problems that came from that. Adam and Eve After the Pill. She reflects on how the pill has changed how women perceive their bodies and how men perceive women's bodies. If you want a story, a sort of the inside account of how this sexual revolution was sold to women, I recommend a book by a woman named Sue Ellen Browder called Subverted. She tells the story of how there was actually an effort on the part of men to subvert the movement for women's equality, to take it away from, you know, things like equal pay for equal work and women's work being respected, and move it toward the sexual revolution and making women more and more available for the sexual pleasure of men. So that's a long answer to your question, but I definitely think there's a connection between what we see in the sexual revolution and the depression and emotional, social, spiritual, moral issues that plague so many people today.
Steve, your response.
I have no response. That answers very well. Thank you very much.
Great. Glad we could help. Steve, thanks very much for that call. Let's go to John in Bethesda, Maryland, listening to EWTN on Sirius Satellite Radio. John, your question for Mark Brumley.
Yeah, I'm confused about how good works have a bearing on my salvation. I'm 59 years old, and I'm still confused about how to get to heaven. I saw a video by Jimmy Akin on your site, and it was okay. I mean, he gives me the, you know, you got to repent, baptize, have faith. But, you know, I'm still confused. And my buddies who are evangelical, I mean, they got a real simple, you know, answer to how to get to heaven. You just faith alone. And it seems like all the good works just are building up treasures in heaven. And I was kidding to your guy who got that took me on the call, like, you know, if that's the case, I'm okay being in the Motel 6 part of heaven, and they can be in the Ritz-Carlton part of heaven, right? So, I mean, I just don't know how it works.
All right, John. Thanks.
One thing I would say, if we think of salvation in terms of relationship, how we relate to God, who is our origin, he's our sustainer, he's our destiny. And we need salvation because we are not we do things that put us at odds with our origin, our sustainer, and our destiny. And those things that we do that put us at odds with him are called sins. So salvation is that process of becoming rightly related to God again as a result of being out of relationship with God through sin. You're right, evangelicals often will talk about justification by faith or by faith alone. And by that, what I think they're trying to get at is the idea that we don't establish a relationship with God on our own terms. We are reliant on grace, on God's gift of himself to us in order for us to become rightly related to God again. So we need grace and faith, trusting that what God says is true and reliable, is the beginning of that. How can I be rightly related to God if I don't trust what he says, if I don't rely on his word? Okay, so faith is very important. Where do good works come in? Well, just as faith is a grace-enabled response to God, and I believe, I'm believing because God has given me the gift of grace to believe. I could reject it, But if I don't reject it, I'm responding by because of God's grace. So too, what you call good works, we could call them works of hope, works of love, works of obedience, works of Christian discipleship. Lots of ways we could talk about them. Those things likewise are gifts of God's grace. Our obedience, our love of God, starts with Him giving us the grace to love Him, to obey Him. Now, of course, just as I can freely reject the grace of faith, so I can freely reject the grace of love, of loving God and obeying God and so on. In that way, if we, but of course I say I could do that, but I don't need to. I can also go along with God's grace. I can not reject it. And so then live a life of obedience or discipleship or following Jesus. I think it's real important to not set faith and works at odds with each other. So that you say, well, you either have faith and are saved by faith, or you have good works and you're supposedly saved by good works. Faith is a kind of work, a good work, not in the sense of something that we do on our own, but something that we do. We do it by God's grace and His power, but it's us who does the believing. We do the believing. We're the ones that believe. Likewise, we're the ones who do the loving. We're the ones who do the obeying, who do the following of Jesus, but we do it by God's grace. So what's the role of good works? The good role of good works is the same as the role of faith, which is to say a grace-enabled yes to God. Does that help?
I don't know. So let me be simplistic about it, right?
Okay.
How much good works do you have to do to get to heaven? I mean, if the bar is Mother Teresa, no one's getting in, right? So the argument, if you use the word grace-enabled works, right?
Well, I would say how much believing do you have to do to get in?
John?
Excuse me? Yeah.
How much believing do you have to do to get in? How much faith do you have to have?
I would say you don't have to have. I mean, as long as you believe in Jesus and He rose from the dead, I mean, that's enough, isn't it?
Well, but how much do you have to believe? Because remember, you can have different levels of faith. Jesus once encountered a man who said, I have faith, but I believe, but help my unbelief. In other words, I don't have a lot of faith. I don't have much faith. So how much faith do you need? I'm going to say you need as much faith as God offers you. In other words, God gives you the grace to believe. You got to say yes to that. You've got to respond to it. You could say no. So anytime God gives you a grace, you know, you have the opportunity to respond to it. So there's no quantified amount of faith that you have to be saved, or quantified amount of response to God's grace and good works to be saved. It's about a relationship. It's not about getting a grade on a test or how many prayers you say or how many acts of charity you say. It's when God gives me the grace to believe, when God gives me the grace to trust Him, when God gives me the grace to obey Him, do I respond with faith, hope, and charity, or do I turn away in sin? That's the answer.
And we have to leave it there, John. I hope that was indeed helpful to you, but we got to take a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Mark Brumley on Catholic Answers Live right after this.
Call us now with your question.
Hello?
On Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our fifth annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there.
We've had a wonderful time going home all enthused.
Every time we come here, it's just an incredible experience.
Normally, you'd have to root through a dozen different books to get half the stuff I've learned here.
These guys are so amazing. I always get so much, learn so much. I've already signed up for next year.
Join us this September 27th to the 30th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. All of your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and special keynote speaker, Raymond Leo Cardinal Burke.
I enjoy the atmosphere and the friendliness of the people, and I'm having a great time.
I love it. I love it. I'm so glad I came here.
I've just learned so much. You know, I've been a Catholic all my life. It's just been so wonderful.
I love it. I want to come back every year.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is. Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking resource by apologist Trent Horn. That one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into, or back to, the practice of the Catholic faith. This Lent, plant seeds of faith in the hearts and minds of your non-Catholic friends and family. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today. You can order your copies of Why We're Catholic by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live, open forum where you get to ask any question that you have on the Catholic faith, 888-318-7884. The number, Mark Brumley is our guest this hour. Let's go to Mark in another Mark. Mark, talk to Mark.
Hey.
Mark, this is Mark from Fort Worth, Texas. Mark, your question for Mark.
Hi there. My question is about mortal sin. I recently learned that, well, let me preface it with this. I think a lot of us, when we think of a mortal sin, we think of extremely grave things like murder, right? But I recently learned that the Catholic Church teaches that if I eat meat on Friday during Lent or I miss Mass on Sunday, that those are both considered mortal sins if I do them of my own choosing. In other words, I didn't just forget, or, you know, I had unavoidable work complications on Sunday or something like that, but I chose to miss Mass because I was lazy or whatever, that's considered a mortal sin. And I'm having trouble reconciling that teaching with the fact that, you know, if I commit a mortal sin, the Catholic Church is very clear that, you know, even one mortal sin, if I don't go to confession and confess that, then I'm going to hell. And I'm having trouble reconciling, okay, if I spend my life as a good Catholic and one Sunday choose not to go to church and I get hit by a bus on Monday, I'm going to hell. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Sure. One of the difficulties we have is we sometimes create these hypotheticals that are hard to make sense of. What you described, you know, the good Catholic who, you know, has been good all of his life, and then just one Sunday out of the blue, he decides he's going to commit a mortal sin, and then God decides, now I'm going to run you over with a Mack truck at this point, and then I'm going to disregard everything about your relationship with me up to this one point. I think that's an example of one of those hypotheticals. I would say, well, do we think that that's how God, who desires everybody to be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth, as St. Paul says, is going to order providence? He's going to see to it that somebody who's been living in right relationship with him all of this time, you know, falls into sin, and that's it. He's going to get hit. He's going to die. I'm going to say no, that God's providence and care and love for us is such that he's not going to play tricks on us. Even when we do something that's gravely sinful, he's not out to condemn us to hell. So I think he's going to order history in such a way as to be the ever-present loving God that we know that he is. Now, with respect to the question, can you commit a mortal sin by doing something like missing Mass on Sunday or eating meat on Friday during Lent? The answer is yes, you can. These things can be grave matter. That is to say, they can be seriously wrong. If somebody knows that it is the will of Christ, let's put it in those terms, the will of God even, that you be at Mass on Sunday and you be worshiping at Mass on Sunday. And I know that that's God's will for me, and I choose to disregard that. I'm not sick. I could be there. I'm capable of coming. I just say, I'm not going to go this Sunday. I'm going to sit home and read the newspaper. Is that gravely sinful? You bet. Why? Because being in church is so important? Well, it is important, but doing what God wants is what's at the core of being at church on Sunday. And violating one of the Ten Commandments, keep holy the Lord's Day, which we Christians understand to apply to participating in divine worship on Sundays, to know that that's a requirement of God and do the opposite. I know it's wrong and I freely choose to do it. Yeah, that puts me out of right relationship with God. We call that, and it does so in a serious way. And we call that a mortal sin. Now, is everybody who commits a mortal sin, is God just waiting to pounce on them and cause their death so that he can send them to hell? No, I don't believe that's true. But it is possible for us to sin gravely, even about things like rules regarding fasting and rules regarding church attendance. Because these things are not just rules. They are ways in which God, through Jesus Christ and the church he's established, contours or shapes our relationship with him. And so when we know that he's involved and we choose to sin anyway, do the wrong thing anyway, then we're rejecting him and not just breaking rules or things of that sort.
Mark, thank you for the question. And Mark, thank you for the answer. And
sure.
We're short on time, so I'm going to move on. I hope that was helpful to you, Mark, the Fort Worth, Texas, Mark. Let's go to Kathy in Lake Orion, Michigan. Kathy, you are on with Mark Brumley. Your question.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, or my statement, first of all, is it seems like the idea of karma and reincarnation is becoming trendy or popular among many people. What is the best way to explain to someone that these beliefs are untrue, to either evangelize them or bring them back to faith?
You got about two minutes, boy. Too, Mark.
That's a big question. As with many questions like this, the answer depends on who you're talking to, what their context is. It's like if you ask me, how do I get to San Diego? Well, I got to know what your starting point is in order to tell you how to get to your destination. So if we're talking with somebody who starts from a Christian background and who may not understand what Christianity says or what Judaism says about the future and the afterlife, it's good to clarify that. The Christian view, the Jewish view, and the Christian view is that there's one life. It's a gift from God, and during this life, we respond to God and we establish our eternal relationship with God on the basis of how we respond to him now. As Hebrews says, it's appointed to man to live and die once, and then after that comes judgment. So that's the first point. If you're talking to a Christian, to help clarify that Scripture, the Bible, Jesus doesn't teach reincarnation, but teaches there's this life, then there's a judgment, and the life to come. That's the first point. The second point, if you're talking to someone who's not a Christian, doesn't really operate from a Christian background, you might ask the question, why do you think reincarnation is true? What makes you think there is such a thing as reincarnation? And usually the answer is either a religious source, some other religious tradition, or sort of a popular culture. This is an idea that's been circulated in popular culture. This is what I've heard. And I think it's important to push on that a little bit, push back and say, what reason have we to suppose there is such a thing as reincarnation? And just kind of hear what the person has to say. I think there's an argument that we might call a philosophical argument that has to do with the nature of the human person. But before you get to that, you kind of have to have some sense that the person you're talking to has a philosophical background.
Kathy, thank you very, very much for that call. You can hear the music, so that means we are at the top of the hour.
I was going to ask Kathy what kind of person she was talking about, but we got to go.
But you gave her the where you got to start where they are. Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, thank you so much for coming in and doing open forum with us to start our Monday off.
Thank you, Si. God bless you.
You too, Mark. Thank you very much. Coming up next hour, Don Johnson will be here. Not the actor, but the filmmaker. We're going to talk a bit about. We'll be right back after this on Catholic Answers Live.